came to Alcoholics Anonymous almost 17 years ago, and I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I truly did not want to be an alcoholic. I didn't know what an alcoholic was, but I didn't want to be it. And I came in here and I was very sick and very hostile. I'd come before that and I left and graduated from Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 23 years of age and I didn't want to be an alcoholic. Life was just beginning for me. I didn't know there was almost over 8 months later. I weighed 85 pounds when I had to start with cirrhosis of the liver, and I didn't know which end was up. When I came here, I came into a group of people. I'm shaking so bad, folks, it's unbelievable. You know, to talk about, you know, I do this because I miss the agony. Diane asked me earlier, if you ever get over it, you don't get over it, you know, you just keep doing it. I came into a group of people who were people who talked a great deal about the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and who people who talked about taking action in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and people who were very active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I am very, very grateful to those people today. I am truly, truly grateful to them. My attitude wasn't always that way. I used to pray that they all die. After I was here a while, because they all remembered me when. And they talked about these 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I used to wonder where they were and how often I'd have to run up and down them. And I thought, I'd never get another thing done in my life. And they said, clean house. And I went home and I cleaned my house. I did clean this house in Westminster. And they said, that's not the kind of house cleaning we're talking about, Annie. We're talking about that house cleaning inside of you. I remember when I was about 4 months sober, and I always start my talk like this, because it's the only way I know how to tell you. But I was about 3 or 4 months sober, and I ran into this meeting, and I went in and I said, where are those steps, and how often do I have to run up and down them? And the guy looked at me and he said, Annie, he said, you go to a lot of meetings. At that time I was going to 2 meetings a day, because I had to go to 2 meetings a day. It was the only place I could be safe or feel safe, was sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I still am a big meeting goer, you know. I mean, people look at me and they think, you know, you're still going to meetings. And I say, yeah, I'm still going to meetings. And he said, you hear those steps read all the time. He said, every meeting you go to, you hear those steps. He said, you listen. And I listened that night, and I heard the steps for me. The steps have changed for me through the years, because, see, I'm not the same person now that I was then. I'm not even the same person I was yesterday. Because I really believe that every day we change. And I heard the steps, and this is how I heard them for the first time in Alcoholics Anonymous. The first step says we admit we're powerless over alcohol and allow it to become unmanageable. Now, I could admit that I was powerless over alcohol. I didn't get to Alcoholics Anonymous because I drank too much coffee. I never drank the bloody stuff until I got here. Yeah. But I could not admit my life was unmanageable. I never managed my life. I roared right through it. I thought about something and I went and did it. I would like to tell you that I've taken the second half of that step 100%, but I haven't, because sometimes during the week or the month, I am into management. I miss my calling in life. There's a part in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous that says, God is the director, and we're the agents, and I want to be the director and let him be the agent. And he's got a real weird sense of humor. He doesn't like me to be the director. I get in and I manage my husband, and I manage my kids, and I manage some of those girls I sponsor. And then I have to go back and say, my God, how dare you? Your life is so unmanageable and you're in there managing other people. And so I haven't taken the second half of that step 100% yet for me. The second step says that we came to believe a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And I came to believe that a power greater than myself was here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it has restored me to some semblance of sanity. Not a whole lot, but I got more sanity today than I did when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. The third step, they want me to make a decision. You know, I don't know how to make a decision. I was 7 years sober and I made my first decision. And they want me to make a decision. They want me to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand him. Now, God and I weren't talking in those days. He was working his side of the street and I was working mine. Now, if he was tall, dark, and handsome, and had a nice car, I might be able to make a decision. But I had come into a bunch of narrow-minded people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they said that's not the kind of higher power they wanted me to have. And if you and I were out to lunch, and it was a decision whether you should pay the bill or I should pay the bill, I'd screw up a free lunch, because I couldn't make a decision. So I made the decision at that time of my life to turn my will and my life over to care of people in Alcoholics Anonymous, because it was very evident to me that you were doing something with your life, and I turned my will and my life over to care of you. And I didn't choose one person, I turned it over to groups. I needed an awful lot of help in those days. Now they want me to do a fourth step, and I figured that that was for those of you who drank for 15 and 20 years. You were much sicker than I was, and I wasn't going to do a fourth and fifth step. But there was a guy in my group, his name is John Brown, and he's a great big guy, and his wife was my sponsor at that time. And John is a great big guy, and he stands about 6'3", and weighed about 280 pounds, and if I'm wrong, you'll kill me. And he came up to me one night, right before I had my first birthday, and he's one of those AAs that like to get in your face. And he's one of those AAs that like to shake their finger at you, and he's shaking his finger at me, and he says, "Hey, Annie," he says, "you're going to have a birthday pretty soon, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "Have you done the fourth and fifth step?" And I said, "No, and I'm not going to." And he said, "Well, honey," he said, "if you don't do that fourth and fifth step," he said, "the night of your birthday when you get up and take your cake," he said, "I'm going to announce it all over Huntington Beach, not to listen to you, that you're not working the Program of Alcoholics Anonymous." Well, I struck terror in my heart. You know, I used to have flaming red hair, and I was better known as Crazy Annie. Everybody knew me as Crazy Annie in Orange County, Costa Mesa, every little meeting I went to. I was one of those, and I thought, my God, now they'll know for sure, you know, that I'm not working those steps. I went home, and I went the next day, I called my sponsor, and I said, "Lois, I'm going to come to your house on Monday night." I used to go to a step study on Monday nights. "And I'm going to go to your house," and I said, "we're going to start working on my fourth step." And she said, "Okay." And I went out to the thrifty drugstore, and I picked up some paper and pencils, a lot of nice stuff for her, and I went over to her house. And I sat down at her kitchen table, and I handed her all this stuff, and she kind of looked at it, and she said, "What is all this?" And I said, "Well," I said, "I'm going to tell you all about it. You start writing." And another one of those narrow-minded AAs. And she looked at me and she said, "Honey, I've done my fourth and fifth step. I've done my fourth." She said, "And I'm not going to do yours." And the only emotion I ever knew when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous was anger. And I got very angry, and I'm yelling at her. I even tried to tell her that that's what sponsors were for, you know, to do this. And she wasn't buying it. She said, "I'm not doing it." And I left her house, and I went home. And I used to call her every day. I used to call her 3 times a day because I needed it. I had to call her for direction all the time. And I'd call her up, and the only thing I really, really, truly believe she had a tape recorder, and on the tape recorder it said, "Write, write, 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 right?" And that's all she would say, and I would hang up. I couldn't tell her. And the reason why I said, "Carrie is really, really fortunate to have Diane as a mother." Because, you see, I was almost 27 years of age when discovered through the people, some of the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, because, see, alcoholism does not choose its victims. Anybody can be susceptible to alcoholism. And some teachers in the Program of Alcoholics Anonymous found out, and they directed me in the right places, and I suffer from a thing called dyslexia. And it was a little late in my life, but that's what they found. And so I told this woman that I couldn't read and I couldn't write and I wasn't from drinking or night blindness or, you know, any of that kind of stuff. It was simply I didn't have those skills. I never learned those skills as a young child. And I copped to the woman and I told her, I said, "I can't do that. I don't know how to write. I would have to sit. I didn't read. I memorized chapter 5. I was a year sober, and I went into a meeting, and I asked them if I could read chapter 5, and I recited it for them. And I listened to the man this morning when he was reading, and it brought back a lot of memories to me. And it takes a lot of courage, because the first time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, they asked me to read traditions, and I got up and I looked at the blank paper, and I couldn't see, I couldn't read them. And the man knew it, and he said a tradition for me, and I read it right after he said it. I repeated it. But I left Alcoholics Anonymous because, you see, I thought it was a reading program. I didn't know that it wasn't a reading program, that we're all here because we're not all there. told that lady, and she said, Annie, I don't care how you do it, but do it. Do it. And I did. I made a lot of marks on that paper. And today I wish I had a kit that's inventory. Because today I do know how to write. I don't like to do it, but I do know how to write. And I read very well today. And I'm a graduate from high school. I graduated from high school in 1983. Was the most painful experience I've ever had in my life. But I had a lot of support, a lot of support. I went to that woman and I did that inventory and I gave it away and I did that fifth step. I'm absolutely, totally positive that that woman pointed out some of my character defects. But if you're anything like me, I didn't have any character defects when I came to Program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I didn't have any character, you know, and they want character defects. It's really hard to get character defects out of no character. The only character defect I could see was I was angry a lot. And anger goes into an awful lot of things for me. Anger goes into a lot of fear, a lot of feelings of being inadequate, an awful lot of things. I got a lot of character defects today, folks. I really do. God has truly removed those ones that stand in the way of me helping my fellow man or me hurting me. But I got a lot of character defects today, and I like them because that tells me I'm getting character here in the Program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And God only knows I need some character here. The seventh step, humbly ask them to remove our shortcomings. I always suggest here that if you don't have any children, to go borrow some. Because, you see, when I would come to meetings and for an hour and a half, I would be okay, and I would come into you when I was very new in the Program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd talk of newness into my fourth year of sobriety, and I would go into meetings and I would say things to you like what I did today with those children. I terrorized those children. I terrorized my husband, and I terrorized myself. And I would tell you I did things like I stopped chasing my husband with knives when my four-year-old came one day and said, Mommy, I'll get the knife for you. And you would say things like, it's okay, Annie, you're not drinking. You know, it's okay, you're not drinking. Yes, it was okay, I wasn't drinking, and I would leave that meeting, and I would go home, and I would take my AA coat off, and I would leave it at the front door, and I would go in the house, and I was an absolutely screaming, raving maniac. It took me a long time to work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous in my home. And today I can honestly tell you that I work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous in my home. And I always gauge how well I'm doing in the summertime when those children are out of school, whether I'm really working that step 7 or not. Because in summertime, years ago, I used to be suicidal 2 weeks after they got out of school. And today I really enjoy my children. My children are not children anymore. My youngest is 14 and my oldest is almost 19 and my boy is 16. And I'm growing up with them. I'm truly growing up with them. I made a list of people I've harmed and I put me on top of that list. And I did go and I did make those amends. And I would like to tell you that I take a daily inventory. The only time you'll ever catch me write a daily inventory is when I'm continuing the same thing over and over. But I can honestly stand here before you tonight and I can tell you that there isn't a day that goes by that I don't think about my day. And if I need to promptly admit that I'm wrong, I will go promptly admit that I'm wrong. Now that's a whole different attitude for me. Because when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous, I wouldn't have promptly admit anything. I hated all of you. And I would say, screw them and the donkey they wrote up on. I'm not going to tell them nothing. And I remember going into a meeting and I remember asking this guy, I said, tell them about it. And he said, Annie, said they don't really care. They really don't care whether you promptly admit you're wrong or not. Because he said they go home and they go to bed and they go to sleep. And they don't give you another thought. And that upset me even more. I thought, my God, I'm sitting up all night long thinking how I'm going to get vengeance on you. And you're going to sleep. So I will promptly admit I'm wrong. Today I'd like to tell you that I give resentments. I don't have them. It works better that way. The 11th step says we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God, praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry it out. That was a real difficult step for me. I knew what medication was, but I didn't know what meditation was. And I knew there was something you had to do because everybody talked about it in meetings. And I would sit home and I would hold a big book under my arm and I would sit there and I'd close my eyes and I would try and meditate like you were talking about. And I'd get to all these weird sex things. or I'd fall asleep, so I had to quit meditating. I gave up meditation. And I went to a meeting and I asked somebody one night, I said, what is meditation? You know, when you don't have the, when you're illiterate in all those big words, you know, surrender and let go and let God and, you know, easy does it. Those were big things for me. And I went and I said, what is meditation? And he said, in Webster Dictionary, meditation is a higher plane of thinking. And today I would like to think that I've got a higher plane of thinking, because you see, step 11 is very, very important to me. Because step 11 promises me emotional and mental sobriety if I continue to do it, and I continue to grow, and I continue to turning and yielding to a power greater than myself. Because I'm truly of myself, I'm nothing. I'm absolutely nothing. I have to have that power as Alcoholics Anonymous and the 11th step in my life today. The 12 steps, haven't had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, to try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. When I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous, I knew that everything was going to be absolutely wonderful, because you see, I'm sober and nothing ever was going to happen to me again. And that illusion had to be smashed for me. It truly had to be smashed for me. I truly believe that the newcomer in Alcoholics Anonymous is the lifeblood of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I truly believe that I need the old-timer in Alcoholics Anonymous. I need the old-timer really bad. My sponsor told me she got it all together once and she forgot where she put it. So if you're new here today and you think that anybody, that we get it all together, I hate to disillusion you. We don't ever get it all together. We may seem like we got it all together, but what I found here in Alcoholics Anonymous is that we're all in various stages of our illness. And that's, you know, some do better than others. And there's areas of my life that I have to continue to work on, and I will probably continue to work on it for the rest of my life. I would like to back up here, and I'd like to share a little bit about my past and what I came to, some of the things that I learned about me in that inventory. I've taken a lot of inventory since that inventory, but that first inventory was very, very important. And I want you to know that when I share my past experience, that my past experience, the only thing it holds for me is to share it, because the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells me that I must give it away in order to keep it. And I only share it if not, I don't blame these people, I was a blamer. I blamed the church, I blamed my parents, I blamed everybody. And today I don't blame them. Today I really truly believe that if anything I've learned here in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've learned to take responsibility for me and my behavior and my emotions and me as a person. And I try not to blame you today. But I go back when I was 6 years of age, and I'm one of those that believes that I was getting ready for alcohol way before I ever picked it up. You know, I had all the wrong attitudes and all the wrong material before I picked it up. I truly believe that if I had not found alcohol, I would have gone absolutely totally insane. Alcohol saved my sanity until I found the program Alcoholics Anonymous, and through you, you have saved my sanity for the last 17 years. I went back into this inventory to where I was about 6 years of age, and I only share this with you because to see, you will see some of the attitudes and some of the things. I am Irish and I'm Catholic. That gave me 2 strikes against me right off the bat. I'm not one of those Irish who's never seen the skies of Ireland. I lived there for 17 years of my life and I hated it. I hated being Irish. I couldn't understand when I came to this country why anybody would want to be Irish. You know, everybody wants to be Irish. Everybody's Irish on St. Patty's Day. Today I like being Irish, because it wasn't because Irish could hold your AA meetings in a phone booth. Somebody told me that the reason why God created whiskey was because he's afraid the Irish are going to take over the world. You know, there might be some truth in that. My father's an alcoholic, and I don't know that my father's an alcoholic. All I know is there's an awful lot of stuff going on in my house. I'm the 8th child out of 10. And my father would go out to Flanagan's on Friday night, and he'd get drunk, and he'd come home, and he'd abuse my mother, beat on her. An absolute terror. I was terrified as a child. But I remember I'd be upstairs, and I'd have the pillow over my head, and I would be asking that God that they were teaching me about, and I was terrified of him too. And I would say, please let him kill her, or maybe she'll kill him, or maybe I will die. And I got up the next morning, and all these things went on inside of me, and I didn't know how to label them until I came to you, and what they were was guilt, remorse, and was a bad child for thinking these terrible things of my parents. I went to Catholic school, not because we were rich, simply because that's all there is in the part of Ireland I come from. And people have asked me, how come you didn't learn? My God, you know, it's real easy. All you have to have is thing is dyslexia and have Irish nuns who are frustrated, and you don't get to learn. second grade, this nun used to get me every morning. I could never remember because of all the confusion that went on in the house. And then I would have to go to school. And I could never remember catechism. We'd have catechism every morning when you go into school. And that you'd have to recite something, and I couldn't remember it. And so this one morning, I decided I was going to get her before she got me. And I go into that classroom, and she asked me the question, and I don't know it, and I often slap her right across the face. And there was a big glass partition, and just as I did it, Mother Superior just happened to be teaching that classroom, and just happened to turn around and look. And I stood there and I said, I didn't do it. You know, I didn't do that. You know, Mother Superior saw me do it, and the 30 kids in that classroom saw me do it, but I didn't do it. And that was my attitude every time I got into anything from that time on until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was caught doing something I said I didn't do. It was somebody else that did it, not me. They took me out of there and moved me to another grade, and I was kneeling in front of these two statues, and I assumed I was supposed to pray. And I was kneeling down at these two statues, and I always say 3 weeks, which when you're in second grade, a week feels like 3 weeks. And I wouldn't apologize to the class. And so I decided I was getting tired of kneeling on those hardwood floors, and I went back to the classroom. And I went up and I stood in front of all those kids, and I lowered my eyes and I said, I'm sorry. And something else happened inside of me. And what happened inside of me was you against me. And it was always you against me. Most of the time I spent in schools and dunces corners with big hats on with these. Or I stood outside the door and they called me stupid and they said horrible things to me. And I left school and I went to work in a factory because that's what we do in Ireland, most of them. Most especially if you're poor like we were, that's what you get to do. But I had all those hopes and dreams every other girl had. I was going to find me a nice Irish fella and get married and have kids. And I am so grateful today that God doesn't answer stupid prayers. But I found booze and I found boys all in the same week. And my first drink was a half a bottle of cognac. And I remember that very, very well. I remember my first drink and I remember my last drink, and there was a lot of drinking that went on in between. And this guy told me that if I drank this half a bottle of cognac, he would give me a pound note, which was equivalent to $3 in your money at that time. And I drank this half a bottle of cognac and I drank it down. I wasn't to stop, and I drank it down. And I went into the bathroom and I got very, very sick. And I came back out and I said, give me my money. I would have done anything for $3. Absolutely anything. And I walked up to the bar because, you see, in Ireland, you don't have to be 18, 21. All you have to do is just name your drink, and you get to do it. I drank for years because I thought I'm Irish, you know, Irish drink. And I went up and I got another drink, and I can tell you exactly what it did, and I got drunk. And what it did, it took away the terrible knot that was in the pit of my gut. And it didn't matter whether my father beat on my mother. And it didn't matter whether I had no education. It didn't matter whether there was no food in our house. I found the secret. Now, I didn't drink every day from that time on, but I drank at every opportunity from that time on. By the time I was 17 years of age, my father made a decision for me. I had absolutely nothing to do with it. And today, I truly believe it came from a power greater than him, that God knew that I would have to get out of that country and change to my father. My father decided I should come to California because California, the streets were paved with gold. Now, I'd never been anywhere out of Ireland. As far as I got out of Ireland, it was Dublin to the zoo, and that was as far as I ever got, and all of a sudden, he's sending me to the other ends of the earth. But you see, I knew it was going to be different. I knew that I was going to get here, and it was that family that I lived with, and it was going to be different. And I was never going to tell a soul I was Irish. Never going to tell a soul I was Irish. I'd have glowed like I stepped off the bloody boat, but nobody was ever going to know I was Irish. And I got here, and I remember getting on that plane, and I remember the feeling, and the feeling was freedom. I wanted to be free. Free from what? I don't know, except I want to be free. It was false freedom because I was drinking champagne on that plane. And I got here, and I was never to feel that feeling again until I came to Home of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my freedom came very, very slow. Today, I can tell you I am free today. I'm a free spirit in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. My past no longer holds me in bondage today. I'm free because I worked the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I became willing to come to meetings and do some of the things that I was told to do. I got here. I delivered a family of pastors the next couple of years, and I drove these people absolutely totally insane. They didn't know what to do with me. And I didn't know what to do with me. This woman, I was very impressed with her home, and I was very impressed with her bar. And she used to drink 108 proof vodka, and I used to drink 108 proof vodka, and I'd fill the bottle up with water, and then when she drank, she could never understand how come she was getting a buzz on. Well, she was drinking good water, which she was drinking. These people were very good to me, and I went back to those people, and I made amends to these people, and they were very grateful that I found the fellowship called Alcoholics Anonymous. They knew there was something wrong with me, they just didn't know what. This woman wanted me to go to school, and she took me down to the beach. High, and I remember being outside on the beach high, and I shook a lot because I was about a child, and I shook a lot because I didn't know it was from all that stuff I was drinking. I was always coming off drunk and getting tapering back on, and I was shaking, but I was also terrified for anybody to know anything about me. I didn't want her to know that I had to remember when someone called, and a lot of times she didn't get her messages, and I couldn't tell her that I didn't know how to fill out those forms or write my name. And I stood outside that office, I was terrified of my peers. I ran around with most older people. Most people I ran around with are dead today due to alcoholism. And I slid down the door. I was going to tell you, I can tell you today what I was experiencing. I was going into a catatonic state of mind with absolute sheer fear. And that woman looked at me, and I'm kind of sliding down at the door at the office, and she said, Annie, you don't have to do that. And I didn't have to do that. I ran around with Donald Beach Pier, and I ran around a lot of people using my hard drugs. And I never got involved in drugs. And the only reason I didn't get involved in drugs was simply because I was terrified that if I was caught, I would be deported back to Ireland. And my father would meet me at Dublin Airport, and he would literally kill me. He would kill me first and ask questions later. My father caught me smoking cigarettes when I was 10 years of age. And I'm standing there with a cigarette in my mouth, and I'm telling him I'm not smoking as he's ramming it down my throat. And he took a dog leash to me, and he whipped me like a dog, and he kicked me with these great big boots. And my mother ran into the living room, and she said, Jack, you're going to kill her. And he said, yes, I'm going to kill her. She's no good, never will be any good. And to see that memory stayed with me, because they couldn't even let me out the door for the next 2 weeks. I was so badly beaten up. I don't know what they would have done over there, but I don't know whether they would have done anything. And that memory stayed with me, and I knew that if I was deported out of this country, that's exactly what he'd do, kill me first and ask questions later. These people I lived with took care of that time of my life, and I moved on uptown. Today I want you to know that I took a bath, I got clean clothes on, and it wasn't always that way. I didn't know where I belonged for so many, many years, and for some years even in Alcoholics Anonymous, I always thought my case was different. My case is not any different than the next guy's. No more different than yours. I was telling Mary Reagan one time about what the nuns done to me, and Mary looked at me, she said, Annie, you know, she said, you really think you had it so bad? She said, you know, I had German nuns, and they were trained by Hitler. So you see, there's always somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous who's going to have a lot worse than you. But this time in my life, I remember very well, I drank everything and anything anybody ever gave me, but when I was buying, I don't think we've got any ripple drinkers in Oregon, do we? The 37 cents a bottle, and came in a long neck bottle, and if you haven't got drunk on Ripple, I guarantee you missed a trip. Because I never felt cheated when I drank Ripple, because I could drink water the next day and get drunk all over again. You know? I used to carry my Ripple bottle in the paper sack. Now, I'm not a wino. I guess I'd be a winette. And I used to wear those rubber go-aheads, you know, those rubber things, thongs, they call them. So everybody asked me, what's go-aheads, Annie? I used to wear those, and I had no pair of pants on, no t-shirt, and I give all the cars the finger. You know, I hated everybody. I didn't seem to fit in this big world. I was out here in California, and I couldn't fit. I didn't want to be with those American people, because all they ever talked about was education, and when you got no education, there isn't much to talk about. And I didn't want to have anything to do with those Irish, because, you see, I believe that they live the same way here as they did over there, and I didn't want to be Irish in the first place. So I took the lesser two evils to start running around with Mexicans. Now, my best friend in the program Alcoholics Anonymous, her name is Angie, and Angie's Mexican. And Angie and I sat down one day, and we kind of dissected the 10 nationalities, and what we came up with, the only difference between the Irish and the Mexicans, is that we ate potatoes and they ate beans. They drink hard, love hard, and get the hell out of you on Saturday night, whether you need it or not. And I remember a group of Mexicans that I thought I was having fun. And this guy was stranger than me. He was drinking in the morning. I was only drinking in the afternoon. And he introduced me to the morning drink. And I was getting beat up and jumping out of cars. It was really exciting. Nor may, God rest his soul, says that when you drink, don't think. And I got to thinking one day. Very dangerous for alcoholics to think. At least this alcoholic. They had told me when I got to AA, don't think any. Even if the sign says think, think, think. For you, we don't want you to think for a while because you don't think right. So I had to let them do my thinking for a while. And I got to thinking one day, I took a little hat, a gallon of Red Mountain, and to get the thinking going, I got to thinking that this guy ought to marry me. And I went over and I proposed to him over in Corinth. I found him, hitchhiked over there, found him, and I proposed to him. And he looked at me and he laughed. And he said, I wouldn't marry you if you handed me on a silver platter. Now, I don't know how you handle rejection, but I don't do too well with it. And my next thought was, I want to kill you. One less Mexican in this world and we'll all be better off. I never owned a driver's license until I was 4 years sober because I couldn't take that little test. And God knew better anyway because I had a lot of anger even in my early sobriety, so I probably would have killed myself or somebody else. And so I got him in the car in the Harbor Freeway and I turned the wheel of the car and I took 25 feet of guardrail and went down 30 feet of the embankment. I never gave it one thought that I would get hurt in that accident. Not one thought. And I thought I killed me a Mexican. I learned in that experience that if you want to kill one Mexican, you got to kill the whole family. They don't take too kindly to you messing with their people for some strange reason. Even if they do call you Andy the Irish Mexican. I also learned that when you run with Mexican people, you don't yell cop. I yelled cop one night. It was in the telephone booth down in Long Beach downtown. And he kicked the door and then kicked me and I yelled uncle. Now you see, I have no illusions. There's not something missing here in my head. Nor will people go home. I crawl out of that phone booth, go to the bar he's at, and I said, let's have a drink and we'll discuss this. I also learned in that inventory that I've been terrified to be abandoned. Absolutely terrified to be abandoned. I will stay in a situation forever. Just don't leave me. I'm not saying that I didn't deserve a lot of the stuff I got. I got abused, and apparently I must have enjoyed it because I got abused by most of the men I ever went out with. Some way or another, I had set them up to abuse me. But I was terrified of someone leaving me. I've had to learn here in Alcoholics Anonymous that when people leave, someone else is going to come in. I die every time someone goes out of my life. But it's okay today because they go on and they come back into my life and here we form a tremendous bond here together. I ended up in Phoenix, Arizona with this guy. And there was another real sick part of me, was if you didn't hit me, you didn't love me. I wanted somebody to kill that part of me that continued to screw up. I knew that if you would just beat her hard enough, she would be okay and then I would be all right. I learned here that if you kill that part of me, you kill all of me. Because that's the part of me that you love here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And in the almost 17 years that I've been sober, nobody has found it necessary to hit me here in Alcoholics Anonymous. There have been those that would have liked to hit me when I got here. They just didn't find it necessary to do it. I ended up in... Arizona with these guys. And I got drunk and I got blacked out and I said some things and I don't even to this day remember what they were, except I got very abusive with my mouth. I had a mouth like a truck driver. A truck driver didn't talk like I talked, but I had one of those. And I went after the car passed out and these four Mexican guys came out after me and they pulled me out of the back seat of the car. And they said, well, let's run over her. And they got me down and they beat me up. And this guy went and got the truck. I used to sit up in my early sobriety and I'd see those headlights. And these three guys jumped and they ran as these headlights came and I rolled off that dirt road. I'm also the type of drunk, I don't know where I live. I live by four mailboxes, a Ross Market, or some sign. And this truck goes by me, those guys run, and I get off the dirt road. My hair is full of gravel. My face looks like the truckers ran over me and I don't know where I am. I don't know how I'm going to get back to Los Angeles and I need a drink. And the guy comes along and he picks me up and he goes to a liquor store. We buy a bottle of wine and we go to a dirty motel. And that's how I learned to solve my problems. I have no idea how to solve my problems. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, you talked a great deal about dying. God, I know what it's like to die. I know what it's like to die when you're out there drinking. And I know what it's like to die when you're sitting out there in those seats and you're dying an inch at a time. I died here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to die to my own ideas, because the only new idea I had when I got here was that I might be an alcoholic. And I died an inch at a time. I died out there because I lived over in Gardena in this little room. I used to call it my 4x4, and it had a hot plate, and it had a sink, and it had cockroaches, and it had a gal named Annie. And I had to go down the hall to take a shower, and the only time I was ever rid of anything that was going on inside of me was when I was drinking. And I would start drinking because I was terrified to go down the hall to take a shower, and I'd start drinking, and I'd always overshoot the mark, so I never got to take too many showers. I remember at this time in my life, I remember lying on the bed curled up, screaming inside, I want somebody to understand me. Somebody to understand me. Is there anybody that can understand me? And I would get out of that bed that night, and I put on those old pair of pants and those old rubber go-aheads, and I set out in those streets one more time. And I always found somebody. I always found somebody. And my mouth was always good in the way. It ended up the same way. I get beat up, thrown out of cars one more time. I never asked for rooms full of people to understand me. I only wanted one. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, I am very, very well understood here in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I lived in that little room for 6 months, and I died an inch at a time in that little room for 6 months. And a gal took pity on me, and she took me out of there, and she moved me to Long Beach. I had my green card, I had a paper sack, and a few little things that I had in that thing. And I knew it was those Mexicans that I was running around with. And if I could get away from those Mexicans, it would be different over there. And I got away from those Mexicans, and I moved to Long Beach. A little gal had taught me how to write my name. And so I knew how to write my name now. And I told these people I had a four-year college degree. I'd walk across UCLA campus one day, and I'd imagine I got a four-year college degree. And all these new friends, well-meaning friends, would get me all these fancy jobs, which I could, there was no way I could have done them. So I ended up working in Anaheim Street. And Anaheim Street is Skid Row down in Long Beach, and I was down there for 8 months. And while I was down there for 8 months, I met this skinny, teeny little guy. And he asked me to date him. And I asked him if he worked. And he said, no, he didn't work. And I said, I don't date guys who don't work. Now, you could smell me before you could see me, but I still didn't want to. I wasn't going to get involved with somebody who didn't work. And he went and got himself a job. And I'm still married to this man. We'll be 20 years married on July 3rd, which is... which is an absolute miracle. And I don't talk about him too much because I blamed him for years for what was wrong with me. And I like to tell you that we have this strange and beautiful relationship. He's strange and I'm beautiful. He was probably the most kind and gentle person I ever met in my life. And he comes from a different background than I do. And he was very kind and very gentle. And in step eight, it talks about that we can bring out the finer character defects in other people. And if he hadn't done the one thing that everybody else had done, he wanted to get married, and nobody ever wanted to marry me, I guarantee you. They all kept running for some strange reason. And he wanted to get married, and he hadn't done the one thing that I knew that I would know that he really loved me. He hadn't hit me. And I got him. I got him good. And he hit me. He gave me two of the nights of Shiner's Revenue, and I knew that we were in love. And we would have to get married. And he hasn't laid a hand on me since. He's scared of me today. So we got married and went back to Minnesota. He was taking me away from all those rotten people and down there in Anaheim, and things were going to be different. And a strange thing happened in Minnesota. All those people that lived down in Anaheim, the names were different, the faces were different, they all moved to Minnesota. And we lived there for 5 months, and I found all the alkies in that little town. And I decided that I made a terrible mistake. I met both his parents. Both his parents are dead today, and they were very nice people. But I knew that I made a terrible mistake. I should have checked his parents out more. His mother didn't drink. She didn't smoke. She didn't gossip into church on Sunday. And she didn't screw around, and I didn't have any identification with her. And she kind of looked at me and thought, my God, what did he bring home? And I decided he started to take bottles out of my purse, and he started dumping them down the sink, and he started telling me when I could drink and when I couldn't drink, and he wanted me to go up and fix some breakfast, and he wanted me to do his laundry. And I thought, my God, I married you, didn't I? You know, I didn't know that all the other responsibility went along with marriage. And I decided, with terrible mistake here, we've got to get back to California, find that Mexican that really loves me. But on the way back from California, the big book from Alcoholics Anonymous says the brainstorms are not for us. And I had a brainstorm. Another brainstorm. And I decided what I needed was a baby, because somebody told me that if you have a baby, you automatically grow up. I wish they quit lying to me. You know, I got pregnant, and 5 minutes after I'm pregnant, I don't want to be pregnant anymore. And the doctor I went to put me a beer and wine. I was having one glass of wine a day and one beer a day, and I was having a six-pack a day and a half gallon of wine a day. So there was 5 other girls in that apartment building that had babies that were pregnant, and they all wanted to have their babies, and they all came out of there, and they were all so happy and so full of joy, bringing home the babies, the little bundle of joy. And I was the last one out of that group to go in that apartment building to have my baby. And I went in and I had that baby, and they put that baby in my arms. And I didn't feel an overwhelming feeling of joy and love and happiness. I got an overwhelming feeling of, my God, what do I do now? And a terrible sense of responsibility. And I took that baby home. That girl stands 5'8 today. She's a beautiful girl. And it's all because of the women in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have an awful lot of women come to my house a lot of times, and I see my kids taking on all the characteristics of all these AA women that come to my house from the time they were very little. Yeah, she's a straight A student and doing very, very well, going to college, and I don't know where she gets all the brains from. But she's not just because of being a good student, she's also beautiful inside. And we share an awful lot together, you know, really good relationship with her. But when she was a baby and I tried to be a good mommy, and I'm here to tell you that I don't know what a good mommy is, and I don't want to be a good mommy. All I know is that I'm the best person I can possibly be today with me and my children. But I wanted to be a good mommy. I wanted to be like those other girls in that apartment building, and I tried very, very hard. And I very quickly became a child abuser, and I abused this little girl. Absolutely terrible. Many, many, many nights my husband had to take me off of this little girl because I would beat on her and I tried to scald her one time. I remember when she was 6 months old. I get so ashamed when I share these things with you. But I remember when she was 6 months old, I remember sitting in this chair, this old chair, with half a gallon of wine sitting next to me, just sucking off this bottle I wasn't drinking out of the glass by now. It was just tipping the bottle to my mouth. I remember looking at this little 6-month-old baby. She was a beautiful baby. But I remember screaming inside and screaming out loud, I hate you, God. I hated God with everything I had. I hated him. I couldn't understand why he made somebody like me. And why was I doing the things I was doing? And why couldn't I be like those other girls in that apartment building? What was so wrong with me? What was so different about me? I remember screaming outside out loud. But I also remember that when I was 19 years of age, I'd gone to psychiatrists because people had told me I was weird, there was something different about me. I never told them I was drinking because I didn't know that drinking was my problem. I went to a priest when I was 19 years of age, and I was having some counsel with him because, you see, I'm Irish and I'm Catholic and I was told when I was that high that those priests have got all the answers. And that same priest came to me when I ran off the freeway because they didn't think I was going to make it. And I was leaving internally, and he gave me the last rites, and he sat by my bed, and he handed me a rosary, and he said, Annie, he said, if you die tonight, he said, surely, he said, you will burn in the fires of hell because of some of the things that you're doing. I remember grasping for that rosary in that bed, and I remember throwing it at that priest, and I remember saying, you take your God, and you take your rosary, and you get the hell out of my life, because if there is a place called hell, I'm living it. I'm living it right between my ears. I'm living it. And I continue to do the things that I wish to do. I continue to hit those bars, and I continue to chase, and I continue to take off, and I'd leave that little girl alone. My husband found his escape. He worked nights. And I would take off, and I would go to Vegas, and I'd be gone 10 days at a time. And I would call him up, and I would say things like, if you straighten up and fly right, I'll come back. And finally, he told me that if I didn't do something about my drinking, that I would have to leave. Now, this was the first time I was told about AA when I was 19 years of age. This gal told me, she said, Annie, you're an alcoholic. I didn't know what an alcoholic was. I had no free ideas of what an alcoholic was. I didn't see an alcoholic with the black coats and the tennis shoes. I had no idea what an alcoholic was. All I knew was that I didn't have it, and it was going to be different when I got married. It was going to be different. And I remember that woman telling me that there was a thing called AA, and I ought to call them. And that came back to me when I was 23 years of age, and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. at 6 o'clock in the morning and they didn't answer the phone. And I was really upset. How dare they not answer the phone at 6 o'clock in the morning and I want to talk to somebody now. And they sent a lady out to me. I got a hold of them to send a lady out. And this woman came out and she had 100 years of sobriety, if not more. My house looked like a bomb had just dropped. My little girl is running around with her legs all black and blue and her eyes look like black slows in her head. Just looked that look of terror in her face. And this woman was English. And now I don't have anything against the English. If it wasn't for England, you know, it supports half of Ireland today. But all of a sudden, being Irish became very, very important. And I thought, my God, they sent me a limey. And this woman had an English accent like she just stepped off the bloody boat. You know, I mean, she was so cockney. And I sat there and I wanted her to fix me. He's coming home at 4 o'clock. I got to be fixed by 4 o'clock. Because if he walks in and I'm not fixed, it's all over, you know. And I waited for the wave of magic wand on me. And she handed me a directory. And she said, you go to meetings. And I don't go to night meetings. I got night blindness and I didn't know what night blindness was. She gave me a number to call. And I called this gal to come and get me. My husband came home at 4 o'clock. And he walked in the door. And I told him what I'd done. And he was so happy. I've never seen him that happy since. He was smiling from ear to ear about me going to this AAA. Here we go. And he said, I'll take you down to the meeting. And I said, oh, no, you can't take me down to the meeting. This gal come and take me out. And he said, no, I'll take you. So I called the gal back and I said, I'll meet you at the meeting. And he take me down to the meeting. Now, I don't know anything about resentment. And we walk into the meeting and everybody's talking. And he went over and he's telling everybody I'm a newcomer. You know, I haven't even decided whether I want to belong, you know. And he's telling me I'm a newcomer, and I was absolutely enraged. I thought, how dare you? And the only thing I can't stand is for that son of a bitch to be happy when I've worked real hard and keeping him miserable, you know. I left that meeting that night, and I went home. And I went back to the meeting the next week, and I just kind of sipped. I kept waiting for you to share what you had with me, you know, and you wouldn't share it. You didn't share it. I thought it was a program of you drink one night and I drink the next night. We take care of each other, you know. And I got up and read those, when I told you about those traditions, and I immediately made the decision that I didn't belong, so I joined a reading program and I wasn't going to stay here. And this... I left and they said, do something for somebody else, and I did. I put my husband in the hospital and I went up and got drunk. And my husband went home from the hospital and he said, you're drunk again? And I said, yes, Dean, I've been going down there for that meeting. I didn't know there was other meetings. I just zeroed in on that one meeting. I said, I've been going down there. I said, and everybody is so happy. And nobody in their right mind can be that happy and not drink. And I've been going down there and they won't share a thing with me, so I decided to go get my own. And he explained to me what Alcoholics Anonymous was. He said, those people don't drink. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about. They don't drink. And I continued to drink for that 8 months, and I'm truly grateful for that 8 months. In that 8 months, that gal kept calling me. And she kept calling me, and she would say things to me like, I would tell her how much I drank, and she would say, I want to be your friend. I don't care how much you drink. And I dropped the phone, and I longed for a friend. But to be her friend, the price is too high. To be her friend was to sit in those hard chairs at those AA meetings. And I dropped the phone and I said, yeah, I bet she wants to be my friend. She wants me to go to those AA meetings. And I ain't going to those AA meetings, and I don't need a friend that bad. And so I decided what it was a recruiting thing. I would recruit somebody for you and get you off my case. So I called this friend of mine in Long Beach, and I said, Eileen, you're an alcoholic. You ought to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. She said, okay. I called this gal back and I said, I found somebody for you. She said, good, I'll come and get both of you. You know, those sober members are real cunning. And she came and got both of us that night. I couldn't tell her no, I wasn't going. I was too terrified to tell her no, I wasn't going. She came and got both of us. She took us to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous at the Anaheim Club over in Anaheim. We went into that meeting and there was another gal in that meeting. And this gal said to me, when I was leaving the meeting, she said, Annie, when are you coming back? And I said, I'm not an alcoholic. She is. Look at her. You know, real quick. But you see, God works in strange and mysterious ways. Because, you see, that was the thing that every time I picked up a drink, I would hear that woman say, when are you coming back? When are you coming back? My last drunk was a 4-day drunk, and it's a drunk I don't ever want to forget, because I don't ever want to forget. I don't ever want to relive any of my past if I forget where I came from. And I've been gone for 4 days, and I left my little girl, and I got thrown out of a bar. I got thrown out of several bars that particular night. And I've covered a lot of territory for someone who didn't thrive. I mean, I ended up in some of the strangest places with the strangest bedfellow that you'd ever want to be with. And so I ended up, 4 people took me out of this bar and took me home. And just because I did something terrible to this poor guy anyway, I'm not going to tell you. You can all wonder. They took me home, and I wasn't drunk, and I wasn't sober, and I should have been blacked out, passed out, or something. And I went in the house, and I wanted to die one more time. I'm a coward when it comes to taking my life. When I mention suicide and head to the beach, they all know I'm just going to jump off the curb. But I wanted to kill myself, and I went in, and the only thing I had in the house was a big bottle of Anacin. And I decided I was going to take those and end it all. I just couldn't function anymore, and it was too hard, and I just absolutely was insane. And the woman came across the street, and this woman had stayed up past 10 o'clock in her life. And she came across the street, and I called Ireland for the last time. My father hung up on me, and this woman said, "Annie, go back to Alcoholics Anonymous." And I said, "They don't understand me there either." She said, "Go back to Alcoholics Anonymous." I don't know what happened between that time and the next morning, but something happened. Because the next morning I found myself sitting in this chair. And I'm sitting and I saw where I was going, and I didn't want to go. I'm a gal, I came off of Beacon Street in San Pedro, and this man had picked me off of Anaheim Street and dusted me off and tried to give me some semblance of a home and a life. And the little girl is there with the diapers half off and the legs all black and blue. And he's sitting over in another chair with his head hanging down and he's wringing his hands. And I don't want to do it. And I looked at him, and they tell me in Alcoholics Anonymous that is a moment of clarity. And I said, "I'm going to call that gal that wants to be my friend in Alcoholics Anonymous." He said, "Go right ahead, Annie." Because he said, "You've never completed anything in your life, and you won't stay there either." And I said, "I don't care. I'm not doing it for you, and I'm not doing it for her. I've got to do it for me. I've got to go see. I can't stand living in my own skin today. I've got to go see." And I called that gal, and she came on June 16, 1968, and she took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I sat in my hand, because I'm one of those drunks that like to puke and I like to shake. And I sat in my hands, and I sat by the door, and I was shaking. And all I wanted was you to stop my head from racing so fast, take this terrible knot out of my pit of my gut, and make these shakes go away. That's all I wanted. And the man stood up here like I am tonight. And it holds true for me today as it did so many, many years ago. It's the truest thing I've ever heard. And I heard it, and I heard it from me, and there was a lot of other people in that room. But I felt he was talking to me that morning. And the man told me that I suffered from a threefold disease. I suffered from an allergy of the body, coupled with an obsession of the mind, and I was spiritually sick. And he told me that was the first drink that got me drunk. And I didn't know it was the first drink that got me drunk. I always thought it was the sixth drink that got me drunk. And he told me that I could get sober and stay sober the same way I drank. Now, I'm a daily drinker and a periodic drunk. And I was to go to meetings. And I would like to tell you that I walked out of that meeting and my life has been absolutely wonderful ever since, and I'd be lying to you. I walked out of that meeting and I wanted to drink more than anything in my life. I wanted to drink. I wanted one lousy drink. I wanted to stop my head from racing, take this knot out of the pit of my gut, and make these shakes go away. And I hear the man say, "If you don't take the first drink, you don't get drunk, and you go to another meeting." And I went to a lot of meetings. And it wasn't easy for me. It truly was not easy for me. I went to meetings, and I terrorized meetings, and I terrorized people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And they told everybody else the same thing, "Keep coming back, you know." I used to tell them God sent me to teach you patience and tolerance. And there was a whole bunch of them that used to think, "My God, he did. I was 9 months sober, 9 months pregnant, and I gave birth to a baby boy. And that boy today is 15 years of age, and that boy today is getting more help than I could have possibly have known to give this child. And I gave birth to this boy. He's got dyslexia, and he's doing very well in school, and he's getting all the help that he needs to get. And he made the varsity team as a freshman in high school, and he's a beautiful swimmer, and it's just an absolute miracle, because I put my kids through an awful lot of hell, even in my sobriety. And I gave birth to this baby boy, and I knew that that was going to be the answer. I knew that I was going to feel those things that those other mothers felt many years before. And I put that baby boy in my arms, and I didn't feel those things one more time. And I took that baby boy home, and the only thing I knew at that time was that I admitted to my little self that I was an alcoholic. And the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells me that is the first step in recovery. And that's what I got when I gave birth to that baby boy. And I took him home, and I wanted to be a good mother one more time. And I'm abusing my husband, I'm abusing the little girl, and I'm abusing my son. 2 years later, I found myself in the same thing. I'm pregnant again. There is some things I absolutely refuse to give up. I don't care what you tell me. I gave birth to a baby girl, and this girl today is absolutely beautiful. She's been least affected by my disease into my sobriety, and I just love her. I love all three of them, but I see the difference as we get well in our program of Alcoholics Anonymous. When my son was 2.5 years of age, I took him to a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist said there's nothing wrong with the child, it was me as a mother. I beat this child, and I beat him, and I beat him. I beat him till his eyes roll back in his head. And I don't know about you, but I have a lot of coincidences happen in my life. And somebody was 10 miles away from their home, stopped by my house to have coffee that particular day. And I stood there when that man came to the door to stop to have a cup of coffee because he was in that area. And he took that baby away from me. And I stood there. I used to lose it. I used to lose it. Really lose it. I couldn't control it. And I would go absolutely totally insane. And I stood there, and he took the baby away from me, and I knew that I wasn't going to make it in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was one of those that was so sick. So sick. And I knew that I couldn't drink. I knew that too. And I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I asked you, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, you promised me. There is promises in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and page 82 and 83 in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You promised me that if I was painstaking and doing these things, that I would know peace of mind, that I did not have any peace of mind. You promised me that insecurity would leave me, a fear of people would leave me, and I was terrified of you. You promised me that I would intuitively know how to handle situations that you could baffle me, and I am no different now than I was when I was drinking. And I went into the meeting and I said, somebody help me. Please help me. I can't live this way no more and do the things that I'm doing. And I will not admit to this day that I was not working your 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was working those steps to the best of what I had and wasn't much. And somebody said something and I ran out of that meeting. And I didn't drive a car, thank God. And I threw a chair down and somebody came out after me and they held me and I cried. When I came to you, I didn't know how to cry. All the crying was gone. I lay in that woman's arms and I cried and I cried and I cried and I thought I was never going to stop crying. I used to think that crying was a sign of weakness. And if you cried, you were weak. A guy held me one night while another one punched my face and all he wanted me to do was cry. And I told him, I said, you go right ahead, you can kill me. But I ain't going to cry. And that woman took me to Orange County Psycho. I didn't stay at Orange County Psycho, but that's where they took me. That woman gave me life. That woman was 9 years sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she gave me life that night. 3 months after that woman gave me life, she chose to commit suicide. And I don't know to this day why Edna chose to commit suicide, but I always mention her when I talk because she was one of God's people that came to me. I ended up with a group of ladies who were child abusers, and I came to, for me, I had to surrender one more time. And these ladies threatened they would take my babies away from me, and I ran from them. And this doctor called me and said he wanted to help me. Now, I truly believe that if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous, and if it wasn't for this man, and my higher power, I wouldn't be standing before you tonight. And then I went back to this man because the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells me that those professional people are there to help us. And I brought a Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous and I went to this man. And I found something in this man. I found something in me. I didn't take the third step the first time, and I surrendered. I surrendered. I had surrendered my alcoholism when I came in here to you, but I hadn't surrendered all of me, like the big book said. We abandon ourselves to God as we understand God, not as you understand it, but as we understand it. And I abandoned myself to God as I understand Him, and I did my fall to Him. And I got in touch with something inside of me that has never left me in all those years, and I cannot explain it to you. All I know is there for me. This man told me, I've run out of time, but I'm going to wind up real quick here. This man told me that I wanted somebody to love me. I never felt love. And sometimes it's still hard for me to feel love. But I know it's there because I learned that here from you. And he said, Annie, you want somebody to love you so bad. And I said, there isn't anybody that loves me. I wasn't brought up, I was dragged up. And he said, there's got to be somebody that loves you, Annie. And I left that man's office and I thought of that sponsor who's everything to me, who did everything and just loves me. And I called her up on the phone and I whispered on the phone. I said, Lois, do you love me? She said, Annie, I love you so much. I came to believe that there was something that some people could love about me. And I dropped, I couldn't tell you that I loved you, because I didn't love you. I didn't love me. But I was about 5 years sober, and I accepted the things I couldn't change. And I started to reach my kids, and I hug my kids, and I hold my kids today, and it took a long time for me to do that. And a little gal came to call them Alcoholics Anonymous, and this little gal asked me to be a sponsor. And nobody ever asked me to be their sponsor. Old timers used to get those newcomers and move them away from me because they were afraid they were going to catch something from me, and it sure wasn't serenity, that's for sure. But she asked me to be her sponsor, and I told her I would share with her the things I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. This old gal had used a lot of LSD and a lot of drugs, and she came into a meeting one night. She was about 6 weeks clean and sober, and I looked across the room and she was hallucinating, because I don't know what happens to people that take LSD, and I knew she was hallucinating. And I walked over to her and I took her out of that meeting, and we went into the bathroom, and I sat on the floor with her, and I rocked her like a baby. And she looked at me with the bluest eyes I've ever seen in anybody, and she said, Annie, you love me so much. You love me so much. And it was like electricity went through my body, and I knew for the first time that there was a thing inside of me and that I could love. And I started to cry, and I said, my God, Cindy, yes, I do love you very, very much. And I don't believe that it's so much what I can give you, it's what God wants me to learn through you when you come into my life. And through that little girl, I learned to love an awful lot of women in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The women are very, very important to me today, because the women are the ones that taught me everything I know today. And the men are also very, very important to me, because, see, I believe there's only two kinds of alcoholics, male and female. And I need both in my life. My father passed away almost 4 years ago. My father died from our disease. My sister just passed away. There's been a lot of grieving going on. My brother just passed away within 4 months of each other. When I miss the agony, I go to Ireland. And I was in Ireland in October. And it's still the same. It's a lot of pain. I'm the only one sober in my family. There was 10 of us. And there's all of us have got some kind of problem. And my brother says, well, I didn't come from priests and nuns, I came from alcoholics. I went home when I was about 11 years sober, and I wanted something from my dad. I wanted him to see that I was doing better. And I had expectations. And when I got there, those 7 was home. My father died from our disease, and you'll never know some of the joys and some of the things that I've experienced here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And some of the neat things that happened. And he'll never know those things. And I know that wherever he's at, I hope his spirit is more content. Because I guarantee you, sure wasn't content here in this life. But we were home, and he called us in the bedroom, and he told us how he hated us. And he hated every one of us, and every one of us was a terrible mistake. And every one of us should have been drowned at birth. And I tuned in on that word mistake. My brother reached for a drink, and they took off to the pub. And I stood there, and it was like someone sticking a knife in my heart. I don't want to be a mistake. When I came to you almost 17 years ago, you said I wasn't a mistake. And one more time, I really started to believe that I was a mistake. And I thought, no, God, please, don't let me be a mistake. And I remember reading, because I read a lot today, and I like to, Gabran, and I remember reading in the Gabran, he says, that our children come through us, they're not of us. And I came through those people, I'm not of those people. I'm of the people of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because, see, you are the ones that walked the extra mile with me. You are the ones that sat and held my hand when nobody else was sitting and hold my hand. You're the ones that saw Annie that nobody else could see. And you pulled her out. She walks tall with dignity today. Because you are my family, and I love each and every one of you. Thank you very much for allowing me to share with you.